A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and honestly, I think he wrote it from underneath a pile of cardboard. He and Hannah just finished what he calls a grueling move between apartments. Their backs are wrecked, the new place is a sea of boxes, and the idea of getting on a plane sounds like an actual nightmare. His question is basically this. What if the best vacation you could take right now is a 15-minute Uber to a hotel 3 miles away? He's always loved a staycation, but he's wondering about the extreme version. Booking a hotel in your own city, seeing where you live through the eyes of a tourist, or even vacationing in your own neighborhood. And he has this instinct that to get any proper break, you need to change your four walls, even if you don't change your zip code.
He's right about the four walls. That's not just an instinct. There's a mechanism there we should dig into. But first, can we just sit with the image for a second? Two people, backs destroyed, surrounded by boxes, looking at each other and going, "You know what we need?" And the answer is not a beach in Thailand. It's the Holiday Inn two neighborhoods over.
The unsexiest vacation pitch of all time. Come for the mattress. Stay, because you physically cannot bend over to unpack another box.
Here's the thing. That's exactly the scenario where this matters most. Post-pandemic, remote work has blurred the line between home and everything else. Home is your office, your gym, your restaurant, your social space. The staycation became a default, not a compromise, and most people do it terribly.
They stay home and scroll.
They stay home and scroll. They call it a staycation because they didn't commute on Monday. And then Tuesday, they feel exactly as depleted as they did on Friday because they never actually left.
The core argument we're going to make here is that you need to physically cross a threshold. Leave your four walls, even if you don't leave your city, even if you don't leave your neighborhood. The walls are the problem.
Daniel's prompt gets at something genuinely interesting, which is the weirdness of it. He says he's always felt there'd be something kind of strange about trying to see your own city through the eyes of a tourist. Like, isn't it just going to feel like a Tuesday? You know where the good coffee is. You've walked past that building 400 times. What are you actually going to notice?
Right. On one hand, everything is familiar enough to be boring. On the other hand, the act of encountering your city without obligation might be transformative. That's the tension. And I think the resolution of that tension is what makes the difference between a staycation that works and one that's just a disappointing weekend.
Let's back up and ask, what is a staycation actually supposed to do for your brain that a normal weekend doesn't?
Because a normal weekend also involves not working.
But a normal weekend still has you in the same environment, surrounded by the same cues. The laundry basket is visible. The dishes are in the sink. The boxes, in Daniel's case, are literally stacked around him, each one a tiny monument to tasks not yet completed. Your brain doesn't clock out just because your calendar says Saturday.
That's the thing. Your brain is reading the room, and the room is saying, "Hey, remember all that stuff you haven't done?"
So to answer that question properly, we need to look at the psychology of why changing your four walls matters more than changing your city. The short version is that recovery isn't about novelty of location. It's about perceived separation from your usual context.
So it's not where you go, it's whether your brain registers that you went somewhere.
That's it. There's a 2023 study by Corpella and Stats that looked at attention restoration theory applied to short breaks. What they found was that the restorative effect depends less on how novel the destination is and more on what they call the being away perception. Do you feel like you're somewhere else? Not, are you somewhere else? Do you feel it?
Which means a hotel 3 miles away can outperform a resort in another country if the resort doesn't trigger that psychological shift and the hotel does.
And the mechanism is partly sensory. Ulrich's work from 1991 on stress recovery, later updated by Bratman and others in 2019, showed that your sensory environment directly modulates cortisol. Within about 20 minutes of exposure, a different sensory environment can start lowering stress markers. A hotel room with different acoustics, a different mattress, different lighting. That's not a luxury. That's a physiological signal to your brain that says, we are not in problem-solving mode anymore.
Daniel's instinct about needing to change his four walls. That's his brain asking for a different sensory envelope. The boxes in his apartment are not just visual clutter. They are cortisol triggers. Every box is a to-do item with a cubic volume.
That's why the stay-at-home staycation usually fails. You never get the sensory reset. You're still hearing the same refrigerator hum. You're still seeing the same crack in the ceiling. Your brain never gets the memo that it's allowed to downshift.
Let me ask you something. What's the minimum environmental change needed to trigger this? Is it the hotel? Is it a different bed? Is it just being in a room that doesn't have your email password saved on the TV?
I think it's the threshold crossing, the act of checking in. Handing over a card, getting a key, walking into a room where nothing is yours and nothing is asking anything of you. That ritual matters. It's not just about the physical space, it's about the symbolic transition. You are now a guest. Guests don't unpack boxes. Guests don't meal prep. Guests exist in a state of temporary irresponsibility.
I want that on a throw pillow.
You'd have to unpack a box to find the throw pillow.
There it is. Right back to the boxes.
That's exactly the point. The threshold has to be real. You can't LARP a hotel, stay in your own bedroom. Your brain knows the difference. It knows where the laundry is.
Daniel's question about whether to do the hotel or just a day of sightseeing. The research would say the overnight component is non-negotiable.
There's a 2024 study in the Annals of Tourism Research that looked at this directly. They found that the overnight stay is the strongest predictor of psychological recovery for short trips. Stronger than activity type, stronger than destination novelty. Sleeping in a different bed and the morning routine that follows is what consolidates the vacation mindset. A day trip without an overnight is just a busy Saturday.
The bed is the thing. The mattress switch.
The mattress switch. And there's a fascinating case study from Japan on this. The Japan Hotel Association has tracked a 40% increase in same-city bookings since 2022 for what they call micro-caycation packages. These are 6 to 8 hour hotel stays. Workers book a room in their own city, not to sightsee, not to vacation, just to sleep in a different bed, just a different room. The data suggests people are intuiting exactly what the research shows, that the environmental change itself is the intervention.
A hotel room is a medical device.
I mean, in a sense. I spent enough years in medicine to know that environment modulates recovery. We see it in hospital design, natural light, noise reduction, views of greenery. Those things aren't decorative. They change outcomes. The same principle applies here. Your apartment, post-move, is an environment of demand. A hotel room is an environment of permission.
A mission to do nothing, which is harder than it sounds.
Because when you're at home, doing nothing means actively ignoring things you should be doing. That's not rest, that's suppression. At a hotel, doing nothing is just doing nothing. There's nothing to ignore.
Where does this leave Daniel? He's got two concepts. He's floating. The city staycation, hotel plus tourist activities, and the neighborhood staycation, which is even more localized. Walking radius, no transit, maybe not even a car.
Given his situation, I think the neighborhood version is the right call. And here's why. He just moved. His new neighborhood is already unfamiliar. That's actually an advantage he hasn't factored in. His tourist gaze is already partially activated because the surroundings are novel. The problem isn't the neighborhood. The problem is the boxes inside.
He doesn't need to go far. He needs to go out and then not come back until morning.
Book a hotel within walking distance of the new apartment or a short Uber. Spend the day exploring the new neighborhood as if he just arrived in a foreign city. Notice the cafes, the parks, the way the light hits the buildings. And then sleep in the hotel. That gives him the being away effect while simultaneously building familiarity with his new home. It's a double benefit.
That's elegant. He's not escaping his new life. He's accelerating his connection to it, but from a position of rest.
The weirdness he mentioned, the strangeness of being a tourist in your own city, that's actually a feature, not a bug. There's a concept in tourism studies called the tourist gaze. When you're a tourist, you scan your environment for novelty. You notice architecture, street details, the texture of a neighborhood. When you're a local, your brain filters all that out as irrelevant to your goals, getting to work, buying groceries. A staycation forces you to deliberately switch from instrumental perception to aesthetic perception, and that switch is trainable.
The weirdness is the mechanism. The slight discomfort of looking at your own street like you've never seen it before. That's the signal that it's working.
It's the signal that you've stopped treating your environment as a series of errands and started treating it as a place.
Which is a pretty good definition of what a vacation is supposed to do. It's not about geography. It's about how you're looking.
That distinction between looking at your environment as a series of tasks versus looking at it as a place, that's really the line between a normal weekend and a staycation. A normal weekend, you're still in task mode. You're running errands, you're doing laundry, you're looking at the same walls while thinking about Monday. The staycation, done right, is a deliberate shift in perceptual mode.
Let's map the actual spectrum Daniel's working with, because he's floating three different versions, and they each have a different psychological profile. At one end, you've got the city staycation. Hotel plus tourist activities. You're in your own city, but you're treating it like Rome. At the other end, you've got the daycation. No overnight. Just structured time off, back in your own bed by 11. And in the middle, the neighborhood staycation. Walking radius, no transit, maybe not even a car. Daniel's specifically asking about the weirdness of the city, as tourist version, but his actual situation is pushing him toward the neighborhood version, whether he realizes it or not.
The daycation. I want to be direct about this. The research is pretty brutal on the daycation. Without the overnight, you never get the morning after effect. You never wake up in a room that isn't asking anything of you. You never have that moment of, where am I? Oh right, I'm on vacation, even if vacation is 2 miles from home.
The morning after effect is underrated. There's something about waking up in a hotel room, even a mediocre one, that resets your relationship to time. You don't have a routine. You don't have a kitchen to clean. You just have a morning.
That's what a normal weekend doesn't give you. On a normal weekend, you wake up and the first thing you see is your bedroom ceiling, which you've seen 3,000 times, and your brain immediately loads the default program. Here's what we do on Saturdays, here's what's in the fridge, here's the to-do list. The staycation with an overnight interrupts that loading sequence.
The overnight is the cheat code for actually arriving somewhere psychologically, even if you haven't gone anywhere geographically. But that brings us to the core tension Daniel's wrestling with, which is the familiarity problem. He says it feels weird to be a tourist in your own city. Everywhere is so familiar, it's not exciting. And I think that's the right thing to name, because it's the central paradox of the hyperlocal vacation.
The paradox is this. Familiarity breeds contempt for leisure, but familiarity also reduces cognitive load. When you vacation in a foreign city, you're making hundreds of micro decisions a day. Which metro line, which neighborhood is safe, how do I order coffee, is this restaurant a tourist trap? That's all executive function. An executive function is exactly what you're trying to replenish.
The foreign vacation is a trade you might not even want to make. You're swapping work stress for navigation stress.
And navigation stress is real. It's low grade but constant. Every unfamiliar street corner requires a decision. Every interaction requires translation, literal or cultural. That's not rest. That's a different kind of work. The hyperlocal staycation flips that entirely you can serve decision energy because you know where everything is, but the risk is that you never psychologically arrive anywhere. You're just in your own city, on a Tuesday, pretending.
That's the failure mode. You can serve so much cognitive load that you never actually leave. You're physically in a hotel, but mentally you're still running your life. You know the coffee shop around the corner is the one where you had that awkward work meeting. You know the park bench is where you took that stressful phone call. The environment is too legible.
That's why the neighborhood version is so interesting for Daniel's specific situation. He just moved. His new neighborhood is not yet legible in that way. It doesn't have those associations yet. He can walk out of a hotel and everything is not foreign, but fresh. The coffee shop isn't the awkward meeting coffee shop, it's just a coffee shop. The park bench doesn't have a history. His tourist gaze is already partially online because the environment hasn't been fully mapped to his task network yet.
The move, which is the source of his exhaustion, is also the thing that makes a hyperlocal staycation viable. The unfamiliarity is already baked in.
If he were in his old apartment, the one he'd been in for years, a neighborhood staycation would be much harder. He'd have to deliberately fight against the autopilot. Every corner would trigger a memory of an errand. But the new place, he gets the unfamiliarity for free. He just needs to get out of the boxes.
which circles back to the four walls thing. He said, quote, I think to get any proper break, one needs to change their four walls. And he's right. But I want to add something. It's not just any four walls. It's four walls that don't have your stuff in them.
That's the distinction. It's not the walls themselves. It's what the walls contain. Your apartment walls contain your obligations. Your hotel walls contain nothing of you. That blankness is the intervention.
Let's push on that blankness, because you mentioned the Japan microcation trend. People booking a hotel room for 6 hours, just to sleep in a different bed. No sightseeing, no itinerary, just a different room. That sounds almost absurd on its face. But the Japan Hotel Association tracked a 40% increase in those bookings since 2022. Something real is happening there.
Something very real. And the absurdity is the point. These aren't people who lack a bed. They have beds. They have apartments. What they lack is a bed that doesn't come with a context. The microcation is essentially a sensory reset delivered as a service. You check in, you close the door, and for 6 hours the room asks nothing of you. The lighting is different. The acoustics are different. The mattress doesn't have the groove of your body in it. Your brain reads those differences and says, oh, we're somewhere else. We can stop now.
The mechanism isn't luxury. It's difference.
That's the minimum viable vacation. And Ulrich's stress recovery framework backs this up. He found that within about 20 minutes of exposure to a different sensory environment, cortisol levels begin to drop. You don't need a week in Bali. You need 20 minutes in a room that doesn't smell like your apartment.
Which makes the stay-at-home staycation almost a category error. You're calling it a vacation, but you've removed the one variable that does the work.
And I think that's why people find them disappointing and can't quite articulate why. They think, well, I didn't work, I slept in, I watched movies, why don't I feel restored? And the answer is that their sensory environment never changed. Their brain never got the cortisol signal. They rested their body, but not their attention.
Let me connect that to the tourist gaze thing you mentioned earlier. You said the staycation forces a switch from instrumental perception to aesthetic perception. But if the environment is too familiar, that switch is really hard to flip. Your brain already has a map. It knows what everything is for.
This is exactly where the research on attention restoration gets practical. Corpella and Stats, in that 2023 study, found that the being away effect depends on whether your attention can shift from directed, task-focused mode to what they call soft fascination. Soft fascination is when something holds your attention without demanding it. Watching light move across a wall, noticing the texture of old brickwork, hearing the rhythm of a street you're not trying to navigate. It's attention without effort.
The problem with your own neighborhood is that nothing holds your attention softly, because nothing holds your attention at all. You've already categorized everything. That building is the bank. That corner is where you buy milk.
Your brain is in instrumental mode by default. The tourist gaze is the deliberate override. You have to tell yourself, I'm going to look at this street as if I've never seen it. And that's a skill. It feels awkward at first. Daniel's instinct that it would be weird is completely accurate. It is weird, but the weirdness is the proof that you're doing it.
A staycation that works is actually two interventions stacked together. The sensory reset, different walls, different light, different bed, and the perceptual reset, deliberately switching from task vision to noticing vision. If you only do one, you get half the benefit.
Most people only do neither. They stay home and call it a vacation. Or they go to a hotel but spend the whole time on their phone, which is just bringing their task environment with them.
The phone is the portable version of the boxes in Daniel's apartment. It's a tiny cardboard box full of obligations that you carry in your pocket.
That's exactly what it is. And it undermines the threshold crossing. You check into the hotel, you walk into the blank room, and then you open your phone, and suddenly you're back in your life. The sensory environment changed, but the attentional environment didn't. The brain doesn't get the full signal.
The hotel room is necessary, but not sufficient. You also have to leave the phone in the drawer, or at least treat it like it's 1995 and the thing only makes calls.
The drawer move is underrated. Physical separation from the device. It's the same principle as the four walls. Out of sight, out of mind, out of cortisol.
Which brings me back to Daniel's specific situation. He's got the unfamiliar neighborhood, which is an advantage. He's got the boxes, which are the problem. And he's got a wife with an equally wrecked back, which means they're making this decision together, Two people, both depleted, trying to figure out the minimum viable intervention.
For two people in that state, the threshold ritual becomes even more important, checking in together. Walking into a room that neither of you is responsible for. There's something about doing that with another person that amplifies the effect. You're both agreeing. We are now officially not in our lives. We are guests here. And guests don't argue about whose turn it is to unpack the kitchen.
Temporary irresponsibility, shared. That's almost romantic.
In a very unsexy Holiday Inn kind of way.
The most romantic sentence I've ever uttered. Honey, let's go be temporarily irresponsible at the Hampton Inn.
Honestly, for a couple coming off a grueling move, that might actually be more restorative than a fancy dinner or a weekend in Paris. Paris requires navigating an airport. The Hampton Inn requires an Uber and a toothbrush.
The practical question for Daniel is, if the mechanism is threshold crossing plus perceptual switching, and he's already got the unfamiliar neighborhood working in his favor, what's the minimum viable execution? What does the actual protocol look like?
All right, let's build the protocol. Daniel's in a specific situation, exhausted, new neighborhood, boxes everywhere. So the neighborhood staycation is the right call over the city version. The city staycation, where you're booking a hotel downtown and hitting museums, has higher payoff potential but also higher friction. You need transit, you need tickets, you need a plan. For someone whose back is already wrecked, that activation energy might kill the whole thing before it starts.
The neighborhood version has basically zero activation energy. You can start within 10 minutes of deciding. Walk out the door, walk to the hotel, done.
That low barrier matters psychologically. If a vacation requires 3 hours of planning, you're already spending executive function before you've recovered any. The neighborhood staycation is the instant-on version.
Which brings us to the uncanny valley problem you haven't named yet. The thing Daniel's actually worried about when he says it feels weird.
The uncanny valley of familiarity. You're in your own city, you're trying to be a tourist, and then you walk past your regular coffee shop. Or you see a colleague from work. Or you spot the dry cleaner you've been meaning to visit for 3 weeks. And suddenly the spell breaks. Your brain snaps back into instrumental mode. Oh right, I need to pick up that jacket.
That's the risk. The environment is just familiar enough to trigger your task network, but not unfamiliar enough to keep you in aesthetic mode. You're stuck in the valley.
The solution is deliberate micro-displacement. You don't book the hotel next to your office. You don't stay in the neighborhood where you run errands. You pick a hotel in a part of the city you rarely visit, even if it's only 20 minutes away. The goal is to make the environment unfamiliar enough that your brain stops autopiloting, but familiar enough that you're not burning cognitive load on navigation.
For Daniel, who just moved, the micro-displacement is already handled. His new neighborhood is the unfamiliar part of the city. He just needs to not be inside his own apartment.
The optimal move is almost absurdly simple. Book a hotel within walking distance of the new apartment, or a short Uber if walking sounds like punishment right now. Spend the day exploring the new neighborhood as if you just landed in a foreign city. Notice the cafes, the parks, the weird little hardware store that's been there since 1970, and then sleep in the hotel. That's it.
The double benefit you mentioned earlier. He's not just recovering. He's building a relationship with his new home. Every cafe he discovers on that wander becomes part of his mental map. But he's building that map from a position of leisure, not obligation. That's a completely different kind of memory.
It's the difference between learning a neighborhood through errands and learning it through exploration. One builds a task network. The other builds a sense of place.
Let's get specific. He's got maybe 48 hours. What does the actual shape of this thing look like? Because the problem with unstructured time off is that it can collapse into paralysis. You wake up in the hotel, you look at each other, and you go, what do we do now?
That paralysis is the staycation killer. And it happens because people treat the lack of structure as the feature, when actually it's the bug. You need just enough structure to prevent decision fatigue, but not so much that it feels like an itinerary.
What's the Goldilocks zone?
I think about it as the 3-3-3 rule. 3 hours of unstructured wandering. 3 hours of deliberate rest. Nap, read, sit in a park, stare at a ceiling that isn't yours. And 3 hours of a single curated experience. A museum exhibit, a nice dinner, a long bath. One thing that anchors the day and gives it a shape.
3 hours of wandering, 3 hours of nothing, 3 hours of one thing. That's 9 hours. It leaves room for sleep and meals and the in-between moments that actually make a vacation feel like a vacation.
The proportions matter. The unstructured wandering is where the tourist gaze gets activated. You're walking without a destination, which forces you to actually look at things. The deliberate rest is where the sensory reset does its work. You're in the hotel room, the light is different, the sounds are different, your cortisol is dropping. And the single curated experience prevents the day from feeling aimless. It's the one thing you'll tell someone about later.
The one thing also solves the what do we do now problem. You don't have to decide between 12 options. You decided on one thing, and the rest of the day is just whatever happens.
And for Daniel specifically, that one thing could be as simple as a dinner reservation at a restaurant in the new neighborhood he's been meaning to try. It doesn't need to be the Louvre. It just needs to be something that isn't unpacking boxes.
The bar is so low right now. The curated experience is not eating takeout on a cardboard box.
Which, by the way, is a perfectly valid curated experience if the alternative is decision paralysis. The point is that you chose it deliberately. That's what separates the staycation from a normal weekend. On a normal weekend, you default into activities. On a staycation, you choose them. Even if the choice is we're going to do absolutely nothing and we're going to do it on purpose.
Intentional nothing versus accidental nothing. Very different things.
Completely different neurochemistry. Accidental nothing is just procrastination dressed up as rest. Intentional nothing is a practice.
Let's boil this down to three things you can actually do, starting tomorrow. And I want to be specific enough that someone could write these on a sticky note and execute.
First one is non-negotiable, and we've been circling it the whole conversation. The threshold ritual. You must physically cross a boundary. Hotel check-in, different building, different bed. A staycation in your living room doesn't work because you never cross the threshold. Your brain never gets the memo.
The threshold isn't just the door. It's the check-in. It's handing over a card and getting a key that isn't yours. It's walking into a room where nothing is asking anything of you. That sequence is the ritual. Skip it and you've skipped the mechanism.
The research is unambiguous on this. Corpella and Stotz found that the being away perception is what predicts recovery, and you can't perceive being away if you never left. The Annals of Tourism research study showed the overnight component is the strongest predictor. Not the activity, not the destination. The bed you sleep in.
Rule 1. Change your four walls. Even if the new walls are 3 miles away and the decor is aggressively beige.
Aggressively beige is fine. Aggressively beige is blank. Blank is what your brain needs.
Second actionable thing. Deliberately constrain your options. This is the paradox. Too much familiarity is boring, but too much novelty is exhausting. The staycation sits right in the middle, and the way you keep it there is by limiting your choices before you start.
Pick one neighborhood, one meal out, that's it. The constraint is what creates the space for recovery, because every option you eliminate is a decision you don't have to make. And decision-making is exactly the cognitive resource you're trying to replenish.
This is where people sabotage themselves. They think, well, if I'm only doing a staycation, I should pack it with activities to make it count. And suddenly they've built a weekend that's more exhausting than their work week. The ambition becomes the undoing.
The 333 rule we mentioned earlier is essentially a constraint engine. It gives you a container. 3 hours of wandering, 3 hours of rest, 3 hours of one thing. You don't have to optimize, you just have to fill the containers.
If the one thing is a bath, and the wandering is 2 blocks, and the rest is a nap, that counts. That's a successful staycation. The metric isn't how much you did. It's whether you crossed the threshold and let your brain downshift.
Use the tourist gaze as a deliberate practice. This is the one that sounds a little woo, but it's actually grounded in the attention restoration research. Before you leave the hotel, set an intention. Something as simple as, today I will notice 3 things about this neighborhood that I've never noticed before.
That's it. Not a scavenger hunt. Not a journaling exercise. Just a quiet intention that primes your brain for aesthetic perception instead of instrumental perception.
The priming is real. Your brain is a prediction engine. It sees what it expects to see. If you walk out the door expecting to run errands, you'll see errands. If you walk out expecting to notice something new, you'll notice something new. The intention doesn't change the street, it changes what your brain filters in.
Daniel's instinct that this would feel weird is exactly right. It will feel weird. You'll walk past a building you've seen 400 times and suddenly notice the ironwork above the windows. And for a second you'll feel almost disoriented. Like, has that always been there? That disorientation is the signal. It means you've switched modes.
The weirdness fades. The more you practice it, the more natural it becomes. Eventually, you can toggle the tourist gaze on and off without the hotel. But the hotel helps, especially at first, because the threshold crossing puts you in the right frame. You're already somewhere else. Noticing things is what you do when you're somewhere else.
Those are the three. One, cross a real threshold. Check in, change your walls, sleep in a different bed. Two, constrain your options before you start. One neighborhood, one hotel, one meal, one walk. The limit is the liberation. Three, set the intention to notice. Three things you've never seen before. That's the whole protocol.
What I like about this list is that none of it requires money you don't have or time you can't spare. Daniel's situation, wrecked back, boxes everywhere, maybe 48 hours, this is completely doable. The hardest part is actually giving yourself permission to do it.
Permission is the hidden fourth step. Permission to spend money on a hotel when you have a perfectly good apartment. Permission to do nothing when there are boxes to unpack. Permission to treat your own neighborhood like a destination. That's the part people get stuck on.
The research is basically a permission slip. It's not self-indulgence. It's a sensory intervention with measurable effects on cortisol and attention restoration. You're not being lazy. You're doing maintenance on your nervous system.
Lazy with a citation. My favorite kind.
Where does this leave us? I think there's a bigger question here about what we're optimizing for when we travel. The staycation has always been framed as the thing you do when you can't afford a real vacation, the consolation prize. But what if that framing is backwards?
It's a good question. If a generation is growing up where international travel is increasingly out of reach, whether that's cost, climate, geopolitical friction, whatever, the staycation stops being Plan B. It becomes the default mode. And the question is whether that's a loss or just a different thing.
I think there's a genuine loss in not forcing yourself into unfamiliar environments. There's something about being somewhere where you don't speak the language, where the street signs are illegible, where you can't predict what's around the corner. That kind of disorientation has its own value. It forces a kind of humility and adaptability that a staycation, no matter how well executed, doesn't demand.
The flip side is that the exotic was always partly a marketing construct. The idea that restoration requires a plane ticket and a passport. That's an industry that sells you the idea that where you are is never enough. And maybe discovering that you can find psychological distance without geographical distance is actually a more durable skill.
That's the future implication I keep coming back to. As remote work collapses the distinction between home and vacation, the skill of micro-displacement, the ability to find psychological distance without geographical distance, may become as important as budgeting or time management. It's not a consolation prize, it's a competence.
A competence you can practice, 3 miles at a time.
The people who get good at it won't be the ones waiting for the perfect 2-week window and the affordable flight. They'll be the ones who know how to cross a threshold on a random Tuesday and let their brain downshift. That's a kind of resilience most people don't think to build.
Daniel, if you're listening from somewhere under the cardboard, the weirdness is the point. Book the room. Notice three things. Sleep in the different bed. The boxes will still be there when you get back, but you'll be someone who rested before facing them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, naturalists in Patagonia documented a cuttlefish that would mimic not just the color of nearby rocks, but the specific pattern of barnacle incrustation, down to the false texture, and then hold the disguise perfectly still for hours after the threat had passed, as if it had forgotten it was performing.
So the cuttlefish was gaslighting itself.
That was our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently spends his time reading 19th century cephalopod journals.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show.
We'll be back next week. Until then, change your walls.
Even the aggressively beige ones.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.